From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, you can call us right now at 800-462-7413. And of course, along with your calls, some topics to talk about, Zorba.
Yes, fitness trackers. Do they work? I wear one.
I know you do.
I think it works, but we'll look at some studies that show that some of the information you get may not be as accurate as you think it is.
And?
Caffeine, coffee, my drink of choice, my drug of choice. Does it give you palpitations? Is it healthy? Is it bad for you? We'll look at what the Puritans said 400 years ago, and then we'll look at what science says today.
Okay, and what's our recipe?
Mediterranean rice noodle bowl. Do you like Mediterranean stuff? Do you like rice? Do you like noodles? Do you like any of that?
I don't like any of that. Mediterranean is fine, but rice and noodles, you can have. 800-462-7413 is our number. And Zorba, our first caller, is a listener in Manhattan, New York. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
About 8 weeks ago, I had a stress fracture of the foot from the gym, and the doctor said to me, you have to wear that boot. And I couldn't wear the boot, so I lied to the doctor. I told him I was wearing the boot. I couldn't stand the boot back. But this is what happened. I hang out in a bar.
You lied to the doctor. How could you possibly do it? Why not? That's exactly right.
You know, but I hang out in a bar where there's kickboxers and construction workers. Anyway, they told me forget about the boot and just strap the foot up with tape, mm-hmm. which I did. I wore the boot once. I couldn't take it.
Uh-huh.
And they said the other kickboxer, there was another fat guy there. I don't know what he did. But anyway, he said that he went to a doctor, and the doctor said to him, did you know that about a couple of years ago you had a stress fracture? And he said, no, I didn't know it. So what they told me was just tape the foot up and work on it, and it's perfectly fine now. And it was healed in 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So what
mm-hmm.
I want to know from you is, do they have like Neanderthal bodies. Is their body stronger than mine?
Well, no, first of all, their bodies are not stronger. But let's look back. You went to the experts. You went to kickboxers because kickboxers on the whole, as you can imagine, are much more likely to have fractures, you
mm-hmm.
know. And also, you lied to your doctor because what you have also known, doctors do not have a monopoly on intelligence, right? They don't necessarily know what's going on. And your doctor gave you some standard advice. Use the shoe. Because that's how we protect it. But the fact is, it doesn't really make a difference. What you want to do is sort of have some way of stabilizing that fracture. A stress fracture is like a little fracture, doesn't move around much, and you want to stabilize it, and the kickboxers had it. So going back to a second for this kickboxer whose doctor said, hey, did you know you had a break before? That's not unusual. Sometimes we do find that out, especially in athletes such as that. But the answer is no. They don't have necessarily stronger bones than you did. Besides, you healed in 4 weeks.
Right.
You got better. You know.
Yeah, and I'm 73. I mean, I'm not a kid.
Now, I got to go back a second.
Yeah.
You're 73, and you're hanging out in a bar with kickboxers and others. Can you tell me a little bit more about this? I want to know a little bit more about that. So,
well, it's just a bar in Manhattan, and it's actually after a 12-step meeting, so they're in deep recovery.
They're in deep recovery. They're in deep recovery.
From being kicked too much and from too much alcohol. But one thing I want to tell you quickly, you know, I get that crucifying cramp in my upper thigh when I fall asleep on my leg. It's
uh-huh.
crucifying.
Mm-hmm.
I can't,
sure.
I mean,
sure.
I can't
cramps
even get to
terrible.
The phone
right.
to call 911. And they told me immediately put on apple cider vinegar and it goes away immediately.
Well, I'll tell you something. There's a lot of stuff with apple cider vinegar that is folklore. And some of it, I think, especially drinking apple cider vinegar, you know, to prevent cardiac disease and others, there's no proof of that. However, when it comes to something that you place on your skin locally, mm-hmm. if it stops the pain, if it stops the discomfort, if it stops the cramping, if it stops anything that's there and you're not taking it into your body, do it. It's no harm, no foul. And besides, these guys know what they're doing. I mean, they're kickboxers. They know what they're doing. They have cramps all the time. They have problems all the time. You have gone to the experts, and you bring up a really, really good point. Maybe instead of sending people to the physical therapist, I should start sending people to the kickboxing bar so I can start finding another way of dealing with this stuff. Their advice sounds like it's top-notch.
Well, send us a poster, and we'll put you and your co-pilot there up on the wall.
That sounds good. That sounds
so
good. My producer, Carl, will get some information. We'll send you some stuff for sure. Thank you. Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
We appreciate the call. Bye-bye. 800-462-7413.
You know, she really does bring up a point. I mean, there's some issues. You know, I'll tell people, go to your trainer, see what your trainer has to say, see what your trainer does, because a trainer has been, you know, has been taught in some methodology what to do for this, what to do for that. The fact is, hanging around in a gym with a lot of guys who have a similar injury, they have a lot of folk remedies of themselves. They may not call it folk remedies, but they have ways of treating their injuries.
A lot of good information.
It's good information.
Yeah.
They know what we're doing, and quite often, we doctors don't even think about that information because, quote, they're not trained. They don't have a degree.
Yeah. Yeah.
They don't have a certificate. You know, let's go back to the Wizard of Oz. Remember? Yeah. The Wizard of Oz Scarecrow just needed a diploma, and then he could all of a sudden think and do things. It's a very interesting point because if you look at Frank Baum, I'm not talking politics at all, by the way. Mm-hmm. He was a very interesting guy. And he was the idea that there are folk remedies and there's folk information that we can really use, but we don't have degrees. And he was very much for this, for actually taking folk remedies and making them work. He was a very interesting author.
You've been in the gym with trainers for a long time, so you know about this.
Oh, yeah, they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
They tell me about cramps and this and that, and I'll tell you something. I have physical therapists. I understand what they know about, and I have trainers, and I know what they know about. And the fact is, now I've got a third place to go, my local bar for kickboxers. I just have to figure out where they are in Madison, Wisconsin.
800-462-7413. And Zorba, a Chetek, Wisconsin listener, is with us now. Hi.
Hi. My husband has a blood disorder in which he doesn't produce red blood cells, and consequently he has to have blood transfusions every 2 to 3 weeks.
Wow. So he has an aplastic anemia, is that what they call it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Aplastic anemia, by the way, means you don't produce red blood cells. There was a famous drug called chloramphenicol, which was sort of almost used like nothing by doctors in the 50s for colds and sore throats and all sorts of infections, and it worked well, but its side effect was aplastic anemia, which is an awful, awful side effect. How did he get it? Was it medically induced?
No, no.
Mm-hmm. Just came on his own.
So
how can we help? Difficult problem.
Well, is there anything he can do for that? He's taking Promacta right now, but the Promacta isn't working.
Mm-hmm. He's been to a number, I'm assuming he's been to a number of specialists, oncologists who have looked at this.
He's only been to one.
Mm-hmm. How long has he had it?
For about 2 years.
For about 2 years, okay.
Yes.
And he goes in every 3 weeks, every 2 or 3 weeks, you said?
Yes.
To get a transfusion.
Yes. Yes.
You know, I always like second opinions in cases like this. I mean, I just, if it were me, if it were my patient, no matter how good the oncologist was or the hematologist, I would get a second opinion. And in cases like this, I like to go to a referenced institution. I like to go at least 150 to 200 miles away, so the physicians usually don't know each other. Mm-hmm. They may respect each other, but if they know each other, sometimes that respect can be, well, I don't want to bother this person. I'm going to sort of pay attention to what they have to say. You want a real second opinion. So, in the area where we are, of course, I think of Mayo Clinic always for a second opinion. I really like them. University of Wisconsin, a second opinion. That's what I would do. Now, from an insurance point of view, quite often when you're going out of the physicians and the hospitals, out of that particular area, you've got to get a pre-authorization. And I think that's important to do. But I would get a second opinion. Well, I don't have an answer
for this.
Why
in this case? Why would you want a second opinion? Isn't it cut and dry?
Well, first of all, it's not cut and dry. It's not cut and dry in the fact that that's what I asked. Is this drug-induced or is there something that can be done? The question would be, can you get a bone marrow transplant for something like this? And that's where I would get a second opinion from an institution for that. Because the idea for the rest of your life of getting transfusions, you know, there are lots of issues with transfusions because you're transfusing blood from someone else. It's a byproduct. You can develop antibodies to the blood that you're actually getting. It's a lot of transfusions. And is there a way of a stem cell transplant that'll make a difference? So that's what I would do. I'd get a second opinion for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, and you've got to go, as I said, out of the particular group that has it, and that's important to do. What sort of insurance do you have?
He has WPS.
Mm-hmm. So he's got insurance. So right, what
and
you have,
Medicare.
Yeah. So what you want to do is you want to get a second opinion. And like I said, I often go outside of an area, and you can usually argue with the insurance company, and they'll often do that because you want a good second opinion. That's what I would do. So.
Okay.
Good luck. Sorry, I don't have an answer to this, but I wonder really what the explanation for this is. You can get an aplastic anemia, in and of itself, but quite often they can be drug induced too. And the question is what caused this and. Is there a way that you can get his blood cells to actually produce himself? So that's what I do. Good luck.
Okay.
Good luck.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. 800-462-7413.
You know, you bring up a good point. When do you get a second opinion? When don't you?
Yeah.
You know, if you've got a situation that is you've got one physician and you've got a treatment, but you're worried about the treatment. So in this case, you're worried about repeat transfusions. To me, that's the time I would get a second opinion because the risk of the transfusions are pretty great. You know, all of a sudden you get a transfusion that causes more antibodies. And also, transfusions are often something that are a temporary fix. In this case, it's a permanent fix. What happens when he can't get transfusions anymore? Well, that's a big issue.
Yeah. In addition to the important medical problems here, there's just the inconvenience.
Oh, yes,
every
yes,
two
yes.
or three
of
weeks
course.
Having
of course.
To go in
that's right.
and get a transfusion.
That's right, the inconvenience. And then the depression that's associated with a chronic disease where you're going in, you're getting injected with blood cells. You know, there's the psychological aspect of it, too.
Let's talk about fitness trackers, one of which you have, Zorba.
That's
it says
right.
here
That's
they
right.
don't count That's calories
right.
well.
That's right. So I like fitness trackers. I used to be a great proponent of pedometers, and I had a lot of pedometers, and then they would fall off. And pedometers, the initial ones, used to work by kind of a little spring, a little weight that would go click, 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 click. They'd make a little sound. And the first pedometer I ever had, guess when that was, Tom?
10 years ago.
No, when I was 12. Pedometers have a long-standing history. I remember getting a pedometer when I was 12.
You
and
were the only
kind of
person
expensive.
In the country.
I am sure. I was such a geek. I mean, I was 12 or maybe I was 14. I was learning Fortran, which was
did
a dead
somebody
computer
make
language.
You get that or did
no,
you
No, I don't know.
It?
I thought that it was kind of...
You were a weird kid,
I thought
kid,
it was kind of weird. You know, other people... I lived in Chicago. Other people are learning the scores about the Sox and the Cubs, and I've got a fitness pedometer. You know? That's all I can tell you. I'm learning Fortran, and they're collecting baseball cards. There's something wrong with this picture. But, hey, look at it. You know, 60-some years later, and I'm still going strong. But I've had three different fitness – well, I've had pedometers, and then I've had a couple of different fitness pedometer. I'm now using a Misfit.
A Misfit?
Mm-hmm. That's what it's called. I like the name. It's called a Misfit. Misfit. Yeah. Doesn't it sound good? It's kind of like James Dean, a Misfit.
It's something that a woman should wear.
Misfit.
Misfit.
Why do you think I've got a girly pedometer? That's okay. That's okay. I can be androgynous.
Okay.
That's
all right.
But I had a jawbone. I eventually didn't like the way it fit on me. I looked at a Fitbit. I looked at a Nike, and I got a Misfit. But what I did is I've done some evaluations. This is a study that is similar to their looking at how accurate they are. But let's go back a second. how much do we care about accuracy? Really.
Why do we wear the silly
Why are we wearing these damn things?
Tell you anything.
I mean, are we? If they're not doing anything, are they there to make us feel guilty? But no, they're there to give you feedback so you will exercise more.
Right.
I mean, if you're not using it for that, forget it. But this was looking at calories burned because these estimate the number of calories that you're actually burning. I don't use it for calories burned. I use it to estimate whether or not I'm going to get to 10,000 steps. Are they accurate for that? By the way, there are differences. But they look specifically at calories burned, and they discovered that these things are all over the place. They did two studies. One was a measurement, was a urine measurement based on certain things that you ate, and one was where they put you in a room for 24 hours, and they measured how much oxygen you consumed and how much carbon dioxide you actually exhaled. And that one is actually much more accurate because when you're actually burning calories in your body, you inhale oxygen and you burn carbon, you exhale carbon dioxide.
Okay.
And what they found was they were all over the place. They underestimated and overestimated. Some underestimated the calories by as much as 250 calories a day. Some overestimated the calories by somewhere between 70 calories and 600 calories a day. Those are wide ranges. 250
yes.
calories a day are about what's in a Snickers, roughly. So there's a bottom line to this. They ain't perfect.
No.
They are not perfect. Don't think that they're perfect. They're just giving you an estimation of what you're doing. There was an editorial that accompanied this in JAMA Internal Medicine and said, hey, it could be that people should be exercising more. Uh-huh, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that some people should be exercising less because they have heart disease. Right. That might be the case. But if you're only using it as a guide for what you're doing, these things are accurate. The calorie part of the fitness trackers are pretty worthless. To me, that's what this shows. Whether or not you're actually getting to about 5 or 10,000 steps a day, and the goal is 10,000 steps for most of us,
right,
not 5,000, they're pretty accurate, and it's plus or minus 10 to 20%. That's all.
Yeah. That's all.
Assume it's plus or minus 10 to 20% is you're fine. If you think these things are an exact number, forget it. You're wrong. They're not.
Does
that make some sense?
Is a calorie count because you're supposed to look at this and eat less? Is that what it is?
I think the calorie count is an idea of, oh, I just burned 500 calories. I can go have a Big Mac.
Oh.
No, you can't. Maybe you can have half a Big Mac. Now, I happen to love Big Macs. If I go to get a Big
Mac,
I love a Big Mac. Are you kidding? Oh, yes. I get a Big Mac about maybe four times a year, five times a year. I happen to like a Big Mac. I like Chicago hot dogs. I like junk food. I mean, I'm not a Puritan, but I could never go to a...
But Big Mac?
Yeah, I happen to like a Big Mac. Sorry.
Okay.
You know, I like sushi. I like salmon. I like oysters.
Eat all the junk you
I
want,
like
a but
Big
a
Mac.
Big Mac.
I'm sorry. I like Big Mac. But what this study shows is if you think you could then eat a Big Mac because you burned 600 calories, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Maybe you could eat half a Big Mac. Who can go and cut a Big Mac in half, throw half away, and eat a Big Mac? Nobody. So don't pay attention to the calories on the fitness monitors.
800-462-7413. It's toll-free, of course. And before we take a break, Zorba, it's time to let one of our listeners show us Who's Boss? It's your favorite segment.
Who's Boss?
We call it Disagreeing with the Doc.
Disagreeing with the Doc. Disagreeing with the Doc. Oh, oh, oh.
Ho, ho, ho. The following email came to us from a listener named Tom from Janesville, Wisconsin. Dear Doc, in the past, I have heard you say that British sailors were called limeys because they carried limes aboard ships to prevent scurvy.
Right. That's what I learned.
If you think about it, England raises no limes, and they were constantly at war with the countries that do. The fact is that they used vinegar and pickled cabbage to prevent scurvy aboard ships. The term limey for British sailors comes from the fact that the Navy for decades pressed men from the Lime Street Prison in London into service.
Oh, they were called Limeys because they were actually prisoners in the Lime Street Prison. Oh, that's very, very interesting. That's very well. You know what? You learn something new every day.
Could it not exactly be if they're at war with countries all the time that have limes, that as part of the war they went and stole their limes?
That might have been it. Maybe that's why they were at war, to get the limes for the ship. There we go.
Did something Zorba say sound a bit sour to you? Let us know by posting on our Facebook page or sending us an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Our recipe coming up, lots more of your calls, of course, and some interesting emails to come, too. Here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 is the number to call if you have a question for Zorba. But before our next call, Zorba, Mediterranean rice noodle bowl. I was going to say soup. Bowl.
It's not soup. It's a rice noodle bowl. You know, there's a difference. Soup means there's soup in
there.
Well,
why would you have a bowl of nothing but rice and noodles?
Because some people like rice and noodles. I happen to like rice and noodles. You're looking for, like, protein, right?
Rice is okay.
You're not a noodle person?
You know, there are restaurants called noodles.
That's right.
I wouldn't go in a restaurant called noodles.
I have gone to the restaurant noodles.
I don't like noodles that much.
You don't like noodles? How about chicken noodle soup?
Well, I haven't had it in decades.
But doesn't it remind you of your mother with chicken noodle soup? Doesn't it remind you of your mom?
No, opened the can and, you know.
How about, you know, I mean, when I have chicken noodle soup out of a can, I always think of my mother. I really do. In fact, I can sort of see her right now even talking. But I love noodles.
All right, let's put this
Don't you ever have noodles at home, like a side dish where you make some noodles and put things in there?
No.
Oh, no, obviously you are not a noodle person. Well, this is Mediterranean rice noodles. So it's not rice and noodles. You're using rice noodles.
Oh, rice noodles.
That's right. I didn't know there was such a thing. You see, you learn something. You learn something new every day.
But this show is really a font of knowledge.
It's an eye-opener for you. Yeah. So start out with 7 ounces of Thai rice noodles.
7 ounces of Thai rice noodles.
Are they better than regular rice noodles? Well, it's a different noodle. It's noodle made out of rice. It's not made out of wheat. It's made out of rice.
Does it have an actual taste?
Yes, it's like, you know, pad Thai. Have you ever had pad Thai?
I don't think so.
No. Oh, you've not had pad Thai? Oh, I can't believe it. I cannot believe I'm sitting opposite somebody in America who has not had pad Thai, who is an educated person. Come on, get a life.
Okay.
7 ounces of Thai rice noodles, okay?
Yeah.
Can you say the word Thai rice noodles?
Thai rice noodles.
Excellent. If you can say it, you can.
We just did this a second
ago. Two tablespoonfuls of extra virgin olive oil.
Two big tea extra virgin olive oil.
A half pound of fresh green beans with the ends snipped off.
A half a pound of fresh green beans with the ends snipped off.
That excited you, didn't
Why
you?
Why didn't
you
we call it Mediterranean rice green bowl? Green bean bowl.
You got it. That's right. It would be better.
Yeah.
10 cherry tomatoes halved.
Mm-hmm. 10 cherry tomatoes halved.
1/4 cup of pitted olives.
1/4 cup of pitted olives.
Some basil, fresh basil leaves, probably 8 or 10 fresh basil leaves.
Mm-hmm. Fresh basil leaves, 8 or 10.
You know, it used to be hard to get basil leaves. You had to go to a specialty store. But now, as you know, Tom, you can get basil leaves almost in any good grocery store. You've seen them there all the time, right?
Yeah, of course. I know all about that. Moving right along.
The zest and juice of a lemon.
A zest zest and juice of a lemon.
That's right, that's right. 1 tablespoonful of sea salt, if you have it, or kosher salt.
Big tea of sea salt
and
or kosher salt.
And freshly ground black pepper.
Freshly ground black pepper.
Okay, so let's make it. Cook the rice noodles according to the directions on the package, and then run them under cold water. So what you do is you often put them in warm water, and then run them under cold water, drain them well. Then in a medium bowl, toss the noodles with olive oil. While the noodles are cooking, bring 4 cups of the salted water to a boil. Have a bowl of ice water ready nearby. Here's what you do. Blanch the green beans in the boiling water until they're tender and bright green, about 2 minutes. So in other words, you've got a great big pot of boiling water. You've got to make sure it's a big pot. Otherwise, the water cools down too quickly. Put them in. Blanch them for 2 minutes, and then remove them from the hot water and immediately submerge them in the ice water because you want to stop the cooking. That's the goal about it. Then drain them. Cut the green bean noodles into thirds. Then stir the beans, tomato halves, olives, basil, lemon zest, lemon juice, salt, and pepper into the bowl of rice noodles that you have made. Adjust the seasoning and serve. Yeah. Very simple, delicious, wonderful.
We could do away with the noodles and call this Mediterranean rice,
vegetable
rice,
bowl.
Green
that's
bean,
right. You could do
green
that's
bean
right.
bowl.
Could,
double
you,
the green you, beans
that's right,
and leave
that's
out
right.
the noodles.
Okay, okay.
That'd be good.
For the non-noodle people, we can change this. But if you are a rice noodle person and you like Thai food, you will love this. It is a Mediterranean rice noodle bowl. And guess where you can get this recipe if you could not write it down. Just guess.
Wait a minute. Let me think.
On the web at ZorbaPastor.org. And while you're there, you can look at pictures of Tom and me and find other fine things on it. That's ZorbaPastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
800-462-7413. Our toll-free number, 800-462-7413. And Zorba, a listener is with us now in Austin, Texas. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my phone call. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure. How can we help?
Well, so my question is regarding the side effects of Topamax. I am currently taking about 25 milligrams daily, and I've been taking it for about a year. When I first started taking it, I was getting a lot of numbness in my hands and my feet, and even to this day, I still get occasional kind of like numbness that, you know, maybe in one foot, and it's really annoying. Just kind of curious about why that is a side effect, and also if there's anything that I can do to kind of decrease the sensation.
Well, first of all, have you looked at the, you've looked it up on the web, have you looked at the side effect profile of Topamax as it's written on the FDA, and so on what, on the package insert that the FDA approved?
Yeah, I have, and it seems like, you know, there's the whole kind of brain fog and other stuff
right.
that goes with it. Yeah.
Let me ask you, Zorba, what are we talking about?
Well, Topamax is a drug that's used for seizures, migraine headaches, chronic pain, mood disorder, and believe it or not, weight loss. So what are you taking, what did you take or are you taking the Topamax for?
So I'm taking it to prevent hemiplegic migraines.
Okay. Hemiplegic migraines. You want to explain to Tom what your symptoms were?
Yeah, please.
Yeah. So my hemiplegic migraines actually, it's kind of like a precursor to getting a migraine headache, but half my body goes numb before I get the migraine. So, you know, I guess the numbness and the feeling is kind of concerning to me because that's actually how the hemiplegic migraine would start, is that I would start with numbness in my foot, and the numbness would travel up the rest of my body, but just on one side.
So did the Topamax work? Does it work for you?
Absolutely. I haven't had a hemiplegic migraine since I started it.
Oh, so first of all, so it's very effective. But the side effect for you turns out to be numbness. Is that continuous numbness, intermittent numbness? Tell me a little bit more about it.
It's really intermittent, you know, so it's just kind of occasional. And, you know, I've tried to link it, you know, if it happens more when I'm stressed or if, you know, maybe I'm not drinking enough water. Or I'm trying to figure out, you know, like when does that happen, you know, more often.
Now, do you have a, how old are you?
I'm 33.
33. History of diabetes at all? At all?
No.
Family? Have you been tested for B12 level or folate level? Those that can produce numbness if you have a B12 or a folic acid deficiency?
My B12 was not deficient, not, you know, not too low, but on the low end. So I have been taking that, like the sublingual B12.
Okay. You took it yourself, or your doctor recommended going on the sublingual B12?
I think I took it myself.
Okay.
So you thought
it's low. It's low normal. Maybe that's an issue. So your doctor has obviously done some tests for numbness. Have you had something called an EMG?
An EMG.
So an EMG is what we use, for instance, in the upper extremities for carpal tunnel syndrome, to look at the nerves and how the nerves are functioning in the wrist and in the hands. And if you've got intermittent numbness, an EMG, which is a test where they look at how the nerve impulses travel in the legs, might help come up with a diagnosis. Because I'm not sure if this is from either from the Topamax or from the migraine headache, and whether or not you're having the numbness that's intermittent because you're not having the full-blown migraine, but you're having some of the symptoms of the migraine. That would be another question I would have. What did your neurologist think about this?
You know, I haven't brought it up with her. I had a six-month check-in, mm-hmm. and we renewed my prescription. And then we've just kind of been going on.
As I said, I think it's something I would bring up. And one of the questions, as I said, is maybe you're not having a complete migraine headache, but what you're having is an incomplete migraine headache, and you're having numbness because the migraine is attenuated by the Topamax. In other words, it's not a, you follow what I'm saying? It's only some of the symptoms that are present, but not all of the symptoms are present. I mean, to me, thinking sort of outside the box, that may be what you're actually experiencing. It may not be a side effect. It may be the effect of the Topamax in attenuating the migraine.
Gotcha. No, that would make sense too.
Yeah, so I would think about that, because if it's not in the package insert, and I use Topamax for migraine headaches and chronic pain medication, and the most common thing is it's nicknamed Dopamax because it makes some people kind of dopey, but I think I would look towards the fact that it may just be not a side effect, but how it's actually working. Discuss it with your doc. I think that's a good idea. And then if it still bothers you, you may want to get an EMG.
Okay, well, that's great. I've never heard of that before, so this is all good to know.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks for your call. Appreciate it.
Have a great day.
You too.
Thank you very much for the call. And before we take a break, Zorba, let's take an email question. This one comes from a listener named David in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. He writes, "Tom and Zorba, I recently purchased some light bulbs and noticed that they all seem to have a color range on them, soft, white, yellow, daylight, etc. Could using a few daylight bulbs in a room be substituted for using one of those light boxes that you have recommended? Oh, and you should have some more burger recipes. I got your back, Tom."
Well, the answer is no. No. It's basically, these are the color of the light bulbs. So some of them are more yellow light bulbs, so they look like an incandescent light. Mm-hmm. And some of them are whiter, so they look like a fluorescent light. But it has nothing to do with the number of lumens. The number of lumens is how bright it is, not the wavelength of light that's actually produced. And when you look at an SAD box, a box for seasonal affective disorder, it's 10,000 lumens. And they're incredibly bright because I've got one at home. And some of them are, quote, daylight bulbs, and they're a little bit more white. Some are a little bit more blue. I don't think there's any evidence that one is better than another. But the light bulbs that you get are not strong enough as a substitute for the SAD lights. So the answer is no, but pick the bulb that you happen to like.
Have a question for Zorba? The good doc is always happy to shed some light on your life. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
Stick around. We have some interesting research to talk about. That's next. More of your calls, of course, and our medical myth buster for the week, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. 800-462-7413 is the number if you have a question for Zorba. But Zorba, before our next call, one of the raps on caffeine is that it gives us heart palpitations, but here's a study that says that's not true.
That's right, that's right. You know, for years I've been taught that. 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30. 30 years, I've been told.
And you've never paid any attention.
Well, I paid minimal attention to it, but I paid some attention. And when people say they have palpitations, especially older people, I will assume that it's from caffeine. Mm-hmm. You know, that, you know, it'll give you extra heartbeats.
Yeah.
Well, we've never done really good studies about that. It's sort of been shown that. And some people, by the way, when they stop caffeine, do notice their heart doesn't flutter as much. That is okay. But when we do studies to see whether or not caffeinated products in a large group cause palpitations, they don't. So this was a study. They looked at about 1,400 people, average age 72, senior citizens, taking part of a larger heart study. So they weren't looking at palpitations. They just were part of a larger heart study, were what are called Holter monitors that monitor their heartbeat. Then they looked at who actually drank caffeine, who did not drink caffeine, to see whether or not caffeinated products produced more, quote, extra heartbeats. And the answer was, da-da-da-da, no. They did not produce extra heartbeats. Now, these are people who had a moderate caffeine intake. They generally would have maybe a couple of cups of coffee a day.
You're
they didn't have more than five cups
of
coffee.
You're giving a lot of kind of outs on this. You say people that drink a lot of coffee, or
Yeah, you mean I'm doing a lot. Yeah. Well, the issue is about at five cups a day. That's sort of where the line seems to be at five cups a day. We're not talking about energy drinks. That we're talking about people who drink less than five cups a day. You know, whether or not if you drink powdered caffeine, for instance, which can be equivalent, a teaspoon of powdered caffeine is equivalent to 28 cups of coffee. So we're not talking about those people.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about people who have three triple shot espressos every day, which would be equivalent to be, you know, nine cups of coffee. We're not talking about that. We're talking about moderate coffee intake. And the reason is there are a lot of people who drink decaf, don't like it because they want the buzz, the wake up of coffee. And they go, wait a minute, my doctor said don't drink coffee. I'm not going to drink it. Those people can really drink coffee with impunity.
You drink a lot of coffee, heart palpitations.
No, but, you know, when I think about it, I don't drink more than five cups of coffee a day. I tend to drink coffee in the morning, and then at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, I might have another spot. But I generally do not exceed five cups of coffee a day. So, bottom line, it doesn't cause palpitations in most people. You can drink five cups of less coffee a day if you have heart disease. Start that brewing going.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. To our next caller now, Zorba, a listener in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, I have a son who uses an inordinate amount of salt. And when I scold him about it, he uses it as an excuse that some doctor told him that his body throws off salt. Now, is this possible?
Now, what do you say is an inordinate amount of salt?
Well, I sometimes see him like putting a teaspoon on a piece of meat.
That's a lot of salt. That is a lot of salt.
It goes on and on. And, you know, if we have a big castle or something, he just pours it out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first of all, he's wrong in that he's right and he's wrong. Your body does get rid of salt. I mean, that's what your kidneys do. You eat a lot of salt. Your kidneys then excrete sodium to get rid of the salt. So the amount of salt in your body stays pretty much exactly the same. That is the case. However, there high blood pressure for some people can be salt sensitive, so we know that's not good for us. And there is a belief now that too much salt actually over time, just like too much sugar can actually burn out the pancreas, too much salt can actually produce problems in the kidneys. So he's right in the fact that his doctor said his body gets rid of salt, but his doctor never said pour on the salt, have as much salt as you want till your body gets rid of it. That's the other part of the equation. equation. He never said, should I limit my salt? And the answer is Americans get too much salt.
Yeah.
It's bad for us. It's bad for our kidneys. It's bad for our blood pressure. It's not good for our heart because it may produce problems with that. So I have a question. How do you scold him when you scold him?
Well, he's 56 years old, so I have to watch myself.
He's 56 years old. You sound like you're in your 30s. I thought this was a young child of yours.
Thank you. Well, I keep young scolding.
You keep young scolding, that's it.
Well, you should say, you're old enough to know that.
Yes, that's what you said.
That doesn't work.
That doesn't work. And, now, does he have any other health habits that are bothersome?
Well, he eats a lot of pizza.
He eats a lot of pizza. And pizza, as we know, is loaded with salt. Does he put salt on his pizza?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, yes. You see, I knew that. I immediately figured that out. He puts salt on his pizza. You know, you can't get used to having less salt. I mean, you actually can't. We habituate ourselves. And I'll tell you a story. A couple of times, I was in Nepal on medical service trips. And at the end of a month, off the grid, basically eating food that was in many ways more nutritious, although it was deficient in some things because we didn't have fresh fruits and vegetables at all. Mm-hmm. But we had very little salt. There was not very many salt. And once I came back to America, I noticed everything tasted salty to me. Salty, sweet, and greasy. And after about 2 to 3 weeks, I stopped noticing it at all because my body habituated, itself to it. Talk to your son and tell him if he stops salting things, he eventually will find that it tastes just as good. And he should start using pepper. Because pepper is good and other seasonings. But pepper often is a great thing to replace salt things. So he should consider
that. That's what I've done.
That's what Tom has done. Yeah. So give him advice. Follows Tom's lead by using pepper.
And that and every other way.
There we go. Every other way. Tom is leading the way away from salt.
Good to know that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your
call. You're welcome. I enjoy the show.
Thanks so much.
800-462-7413. That's 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, time again now for our Medical Mythbuster segment. Today's question is from a listener, Harry, in El Paso, Texas. He writes, Dear Dr. Zorba and Tom, several years ago, there was a report that women married to circumcised males had less incidences of cervical cancer than women married to males who were not circumcised. Have there been any further studies of this to verify it, or is it just a myth?
Well, it's totally a myth, but I'll explain what it is. It's a myth that's been perpetrated for a long time, and there was a JAMA editorial probably 25, 30 years ago called The Rape of the Phallus, which was the rape. You know, there was a Byron poem, I think, called The Rape of the Forelock, but The Rape of the Phallus, and it was talking about this myth. And here's where it came from. It came from the fact that Jewish men were circumcised back in the day. It was not common before World War II for men to be circumcised, except in the U.S. by Jewish men were circumcised. And Jewish women had a very low incidence of cervical cancer. And the theory was this was due to circumcision. And it turned out the data did not show that. What it was actually due to the fact that within the Jewish community, which was a small, rather insulated community, there was a very low incidence of HPV, human papillomavirus. And so human papillomavirus turned out is the issue. It is the cause of cervical cancer. So it turned out that once there was intermarrying among Jewish women and non-Jewish men, Gentile men, even if they were circumcised, it turned out that the incidence and prevalence of cervical cancer and abnormal pap smears increased simply because the virus was then within the population. So the answer is circumcision does not prevent cervical cancer. Now, circumcision does reduce the risk of getting HIV. And so that can be a reason for circumcision. And it is now more widely practiced in Africa in areas where there's lots of HPV. So I hope that I have now, once again, the rape of the foreskin got rid of the myth that circumcision reduces the risk of cervical cancer. It does not.
That's very interesting. Have a possible myth for Zorba? He's happy to cut to the chase. Just post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413 is our number. And Zorba, our next caller is a listener in Laval, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about potatoes that are still green under the skin.
Mm-hmm.
I can't seem to find in the grocery stores today, get them home, and every potato is still green mm-hmm. under the skin.
Uh-huh.
When I was growing up in the 40s and the 50s, we're talking 1940s, 1950s.
My goodness, you don't sound like you're that old. You grew up in the 40s? Now that is, you're up there. You're up there.
Farm girl in southern Wisconsin. As young girls, we were taught when you peel potatoes, you took off every bit of green and you used the point of the knife and took out every little speck of eye.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the 1950s, when we first got those boxes of Lay's potato chips with the two big bags inside,
yes,
even if we take a potato chip out and it would have a little hole, a little green around it,
mm-hmm.
we had to bite around that. Because green, Grandpa said green from the potatoes was part of the, poisonous part of the potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
But I've resorted to using instant mashed potatoes from a box, which it's not a good substitute.
Not at all. Do you like the taste of instant mashed potatoes?
Well, if you put some chives and some butter and some salt.
If you put chives and butter and salt
and
on.
Some sour cream.
And sour cream. You know what?
But, is it safe? And modern houses, I have no place to store. I can't buy a gunny sack of potatoes from a farm market.
I
have no place to store it for two people for that long.
You know something? You're really going back to the farm. A gunny sack of potatoes,
did I reveal myself there?
Yes, you definitely have. First of all, I don't think any of my children, if I said a gunny sack of potatoes, they would look at me and go, "A gunny sack? What is that? Where does that word come from, Dad?" That would be it. And then I would say, then they'd probably say, "Why do you want to buy those many potatoes? Just pick them up from the store." Well, that was an issue with potatoes, and I can't remember. I'd have to look it up, and I don't have any way to look it up on the show. But the little bit of green potatoes, getting back to that, that you happen to see when you take out potatoes from the market are okay. Because if they were not okay, we would have lots of sick people right now who are eating regular potatoes. So you just have to get over the greenness. It's much better than instant mashed potatoes. But they don't cause problems. And you don't have to get rid of the eyes if you don't want to either. You know, you
really?
Don't. Oh, okay. No. I take, when we have mashed potatoes at our house, we take potatoes, wash the outside, cut them up, put them in water, boil them, and mash the entire thing. I never get rid of the eyes. Nope, I don't do that. My mother, by the way, my mother said the same thing. Now, I'm a child of the 50s. I did not grow up on a farm. By the way, did you have an outhouse initially or indoor plumbing?
The first.
Thank you. That's right. Just want to know if you're a real old Wisconsin farm girl.
Oh, Green County, yeah.
That was it. But my mother would also take out the eyes and peel potatoes. You don't have to do that. They're not bothersome. It's a texture issue when you actually eat mashed potatoes. So you could go back to regular potatoes, not worry about the greens, and they will taste better.
You don't have to cut all of that green off and throw it out?
Not at all. You don't have to do it at all.
Okay.
No, you don't have to do it at all. You know, now, you don't have to do it. It's not necessary. How old was your grandfather when he passed away?
90s.
He was in his 90s, see? But it was important years ago because the green was a signal for potatoes that actually had gone bad and actually produced this toxin that I don't quite remember. It's not a precursor to problems in this day and age. It really isn't the same thing.
If they sprouted. I think the sprout of the potato was considered totally unsafe.
And that's right. And also, the sprout of the potato, it's time to throw out the potato. And let me assure you one thing. If you buy a gunny sack of potatoes for your house, unless you eat them 3 times a day, they will start to sprout at the bottom of the gunny sack. So
yeah, it just doesn't work for two people and in today's houses where you don't have a really cool place to store them.
That's right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You don't have a root. You don't have a root cellar in your modern house, right?
No.
Well, thanks for your call. And thanks for sharing that Wisconsin lore.
Thank you. I'll go back to real potatoes.
There you go.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, bye-bye.
And before we head out today, Zorba, let's dip back into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox. This question comes to us from a listener named Karen in Western New York. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, what is your opinion on supermarket organic chicken and eggs? Is it worth paying extra for organic chicken and eggs?"
Well, let's look at it from two points of view. Cultural, scientific. Mm-hmm. Okay? Cultural, scientific.
Yeah.
Let's look at their limitations in both. From a scientific point of view, science knows what it proves. It doesn't know what it has not proven, right? Only knows what it's proved. From a cultural point of view, it's going with the flow. It becomes a different issue of your own culture. So from a scientific nutritional point of view, whether or not it is organic or not organic, I have never seen a difference, except we know that organic chicken that has been raised with non-organic chicken that is raised with antibiotics, we know that antibiotics have been absorbed somewhere within the chicken. There are many people who believe they don't want to have that in their system. I think we know that there's a proof there. You then decide if you want to do that and you want to go scientifically into organic. You know, some people who have this belief that organic is better, feels better. It's been a cultural movement within America. So I don't see a difference scientifically between one group and another, but I see a difference in whether or not you want to have the other problems with things that are not raised organically. Pesticides, hormones, how the chicken is raised, whether or not it's killed, even in a humane way. Mm. And that's where it sits. I've discovered that my opinion with this, there's no scientific basis for one, but there can be a cultural basis, and that's how to decide it.
I'm sure I'm wrong on this, but we have a restaurant in town. The prices are a little high, but they're organic.
Mm-hmm.
And we eat there on occasion. To me, it tastes better.
Good. That's great. Maybe they have free-range chickens. I'll tell you something. A free-range chicken that has been raised with that, actually, the egg does have a different taste if the egg is fresher. It's very different from a supermarket chicken, especially if you're having an omelet. But for me, if you're having an egg sunny side up or over easy, I can taste a difference in the yolk, and there's no doubt about it. So your organic egg might taste different, and that's a cultural issue, not necessarily a scientific issue.
Have
and that's how to decide it.
If you have a healthy living question for Zorba, you can post it to our Facebook page or send it along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
See you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen, and our technical director is Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping you'll join us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
For more Zorba Pastor on Your Health, including episodes, recipes, and tips mentioned on the program, visit ZorbaPastor.org. This year, we're celebrating the show's 25th anniversary, and we want to hear from you. How has Zorba helped you out? What have you learned from the show over the years? Leave us a message at 800-462-7413.